case is number 06-5016, Bluebonnet Savings Bank against the United States. Mr. Cohen.
May it please the court. Because the plaintiffs, for the second time, failed to prove their damages, the court below held that they were entitled to $96 million as a jury verdict. The court erred because a jury verdict, as this court held in its 2001 opinion, is appropriate only if the failure of the plaintiff to prove its damages is justifiable. This court, as I mentioned, noted that in 2001. It reiterated this in a case called Dawco Construction, which we cited in our briefs, which the trial judge cited but did not discuss. Now, the failure of the plaintiffs here to prove their damages was not justifiable. They made a litigation decision to instruct their expert that he should assume that the but-for world would be involve a debt-only financing beginning in 1992. When it became apparent that that instruction, which was based on a construction of the mandate in this court, was not correct, they attempted to demonstrate that it was justified by the facts. The trial court completely rejected the concept that it was supported by the facts, and the plaintiffs have never claimed that their inability to prove their damages was justifiable. And since the resort to a jury verdict is appropriate only when the failure of the plaintiff to prove its damages is justifiable, the court erred. Assuming that the court, and I should point out the difficult position that it places the government if a plaintiff can obtain a jury verdict without showing that its failure to prove its damages is justifiable, because, and this case is being cited by a number of litigants on the grounds that a plaintiff is always entitled to damages, to some damages. So a plaintiff, for example, could attempt to prove damages as high as it might think possible, no matter whether fully supported by the evidence or the facts. The government would be required to prove its damages, to prove the plaintiff's damages, even though it didn't bear the burden of proof. And the plaintiff could be assured of getting whatever damages the government proved as a floor on the damages that it recovered. Now, with respect to assuming that a jury verdict is or was appropriate, the court erred in modifying the model presented by our expert, which the court found was completely supported by the facts in the case and was credible. Our expert produced a model that, in accord with the facts, that said, depending upon how the court interpreted this court's mandate, the damages were either $500,000 or $10 million. The court below agreed that our expert had correctly read the facts or had dealt with the facts, and that his model that the damages were $10 million was perfectly credible. Had the court adopted our model, notwithstanding the lack of justification that the plaintiff offered for failure to prove its case, I doubt that we would have appealed.
But they did adopt a modification of your model. Of course, they came up with different numbers.
Yes, and that's another error committed by the court. The court modified our expert's model, and the damages ballooned from $10 million to $96 million, but there was absolutely no justification, no evidence to support that modification of our model. That modification depended upon an assertion that a regulation applied that The regulators would have interpreted the regulation in a particular way, that is, they would not have approved CFSB's assumption of Mr. Fayol's loan without the provision of a note by Mr. Fayol, that Mr. Fayol would provide a note, and that the provision of a note would reduce the amount of equity that the plaintiffs would have to relinquish to 16%. There's no evidence to support that. Professor Calamaris, who was the plaintiff's expert, who came up with this theory about the regulators and how they would treat the assumption of the debt by CFSB, was not a regulator. He never mentioned a regulation. He was not an expert in thrift regulation. He was not involved in the thrift industry until 2000, long after the regulation had been repealed. He was not competent to testify as to what the regulators would have thought about CFSB's assumption of Mr. Fayol's debt. Moreover, there was no evidence in the record that Mr. Fayol would have provided a note. Mr. Fayol is a plaintiff. He could have testified. The plaintiffs could have called him. Never called him. There was no testimony by Mr. Fayol that he would have provided a note. Moreover, our expert demonstrated how the provision of a note by Mr. Fayol would not have reduced the equity of the damages as much as the plaintiff contended, and there was no rebuttal of that. So there was absolutely no basis. There was a mention of the regulation by our expert on cross-examination. But again, he was not an expert in thrift regulation. He was not a thrift regulator. Moreover, his testimony actually was, well, if the regulation applied, then it was irrelevant because the plaintiff would have found, Mr. Fayol would have found a way to structure the transaction so that the regulation would not apply.
What was Shapiro's testimony with respect to the hypothetical situation of the note? Fayol issued a note to CFSB?
His testimony was that the note would not be worth its face value, right, and therefore...
Because the insurance companies were not worth $45 million or whatever the note was.
Right. He didn't have any assets to back it up, so that lenders would not look at the provision of a note as reducing the risk of an investment in CFSB.
Did he come up with a dollar figure? I mean, that wasn't the source of his whatever it was, $47 million equity figure, right? That came from that was his adjustment without respect to the note, correct?
Yes, I think that
Did he come up with a different number for what would have happened in the but-for world in which there was a note, but the note had, as he saw it, less value?
Not that I recall.
Okay. But he did address that question of what would have happened had there been a note, and the notion being that the note would have had less than a complete collateral value.
Right. And moreover, I emphasize the fact that there was no testimony there would have been a note. And in addition, the plaintiffs do not rebut our demonstration that the purpose of the regulation was to prevent putting pressure on Bluebonnet to pay dividends to CFSB. And that purpose would not be violated here by CFSB's assumption of the note, because the regulators knew that debt, or assumption of the debt, because the regulators knew that debt would be paid by Bluebonnet dividends. That's the whole basis of this case. And so to say, it makes no sense to say the regulators would have been concerned about CFSB's assumption of the note, because that would have put pressure upon Bluebonnet to pay dividends to CFSB to pay off the debt. The regulators knew that Bluebonnet dividends were going to pay the debt. Moreover, as we demonstrated in our brief, even if the regulation applied, even if the regulators would have been concerned about the CFSB's assumption of the note, the regulation, as applied here, would have provided for automatic approval of the assumption of the debt. Because the purpose of the assumption of the debt was to raise capital. So,
if Mr. Fayol had simply transferred his obligation to CFSB, that would be a taxable event for him, would it not?
There was some testimony that it would be a constructive dividend.
Sure. Yes. I mean, that's right, isn't it? If you transfer to me your mortgage, that's a pretty valuable asset to you right away, right?
Right.
And you'd be taxed on it, I assume.
That's correct. Okay. But as our expert also pointed out, tax lawyers could have come up with some way of structuring this transaction so as to avoid the taxes. Moreover, our expert testified...
They're going to quote you on that, Mr. Cohen. They're going to quote you on that, Mr. Cohen.
No. Another way of structuring the transaction would be for for Mr. Fayol to borrow the money for CFSB to borrow money to pay Mr. Fayol's dividends to Mr. Fayol, which Mr. Fayol would then use to pay off the debt.
Again, a taxable event, though.
That would be taxable. Unless, as our expert was assured the court, Mr. Fayol obtained a tax expert who could structure the transaction so it would not be taxable. I mean, the fact of the matter is there's no testimony in the record, getting back to the point, that the regulators would have been concerned about this transaction. And without that concern, there's no basis in the record for the court to modify our expert's model. And in that connection, Dalko, again, seems to be right on point. In that case, the plaintiff demonstrated damages of about $8,000. The court, as a jury verdict, increased those damages from $8,000 to $500,000. And this court reversed on the grounds that got to show that the inability to prove damages is justifiable, such as the loss of records through no fault of the plaintiff.
Okay, do you want to save the rest of your time, Mr. Cohen?
I will. So for those reasons, the judgment ought to be reversed, or at a minimum, maximum, it ought to be reversed and remanded with directions to enter a judgment for $10 million.
Thank you. Mr. Berger?
May it please the court. The Court of Federal Claims did precisely what this court asked it to do on remand in Bluebonnet 5. It reviewed all of the evidence. It conducted further proceedings that it considered appropriate. It used its intimate familiarity with the facts. We're talking about 7,000 pages of transcript over a 25-day trial in 1999. It conducted further proceedings by receiving 6 additional days of expert testimony in 2005. He calculated damages, as this court said, by determining the costs that resulted from the breach of contract and reducing that amount by the amount of the costs the plaintiffs would have experienced absent the breach. Now, he also was told in Bluebonnet 5, at a minimum, jury verdict damages would be appropriate in this case. This court said, we reiterate the point we made in Bluebonnet 3, that jury verdict damages would be appropriate in this case. Overall, he was told that through this process, he should make a fair and reasonable approximation of damages that would compensate the plaintiffs for the net financial effect of the breach. That is precisely what he did. That is precisely what he said he did. As I mentioned, he reviewed all of the evidence from the 1999 trial. He received 6 additional days of expert testimony. Mr. Collins says, well, we could have put on Mr. Fayol. Well, that overlooks the fact that the court said, after remand, what do the parties want to do? I would like your suggestions. Both the government and we said there's no additional factual evidence that is required. We simply each want to submit expert testimony. The government is not in a position to claim that all of a sudden this should have been a retrial, because it wasn't. Now, he placed all of this evidence, the fact evidence from 1999, the expert testimony from 2005, into the context of this court's two prior opinions, as well as his own fact findings from the 1999 trial, which this court had affirmed. Now, he reaffirmed his own prior holding that there is no doubt that the plaintiffs in this case were harmed, and he put himself in the position of a jury to arrive at a fair, reasonable approximation of plaintiffs' damages. Using the jury verdict method, he calculated an award that he said himself expressly, fairly compensated plaintiffs for the net financial effect of the breach and not a penny more or less. That's what this court asked him to do. That's what he did. I would suggest that the jury verdict award is entitled to double-barreled deference. First, because the underlying fact findings are not clearly erroneous. And second, because Judge Fumpei did not abuse the wide-ranging discretion that this court asked him to use in quantifying damages. Under these case-specific circumstances, the jury verdict award deserves to be affirmed. Any other result will really divest the trial court of what this court envisioned, that he would act as a proxy for a jury and as a fact finder. Instead, it would simply turn the trial court into a weigh station en route to this court for second guessing of the damages amount. Now, the government really can't point to anything that resembles clear error or abuse of discretion, despite the court's mandate that jury verdict damages would be appropriate in this case. They say, well, he forgot to apply the justifiable inability prong. Well, unfortunately, the justifiable inability prong doesn't have anything to do with the exercise that this court asked Judge Fumpei to conduct. There has never been any doubt in this case about what plaintiff's actual breach cause costs were. Justifiable inability pertains only to the actual cost component. That's what this court said in Bluebonnet 3, 266 F3rd at 1358, when it said, even if Bluebonnet had been justifiably unable to prove the cost of the EBA, but in fact they did. Now, Donko itself, 872 F2nd at 881, makes clear that justifiable inability has to do with actual cost. That's a case where there was going to be the grading of a plot of land this big, and then the contract was changed and it was half the size. And what happened was the contractor didn't keep track of his actual costs for grading this smaller plot of land. And what this court said was, you've got to show that there's some justification when you're not keeping track of the actual costs. Here, what this court said in Bluebonnet 5 was, we know all about actual costs. That part's clear. What we need to do is offset but for costs, if any. That was the exercise. There is no way with certainty ever to determine what costs would have been in a what-if but for world. That's why this court said to Judge Fumpei, use your intimate familiarity with the facts. You are closer to the facts than anybody. And help us wrestle with this complex question of what the but-for costs would have been. That's what he would have done. That's what he did, what he was asked to do, and that's what he said he did. The government simply doesn't like how Judge Fumpei exercised his broad discretion in the context of his intimate familiarity with the facts. If the decimal point in this damages award had shifted just one place to the left, the government would have nothing but praise for the decisional process that Judge Fumpei used. But of course, the test for affirmance does not depend on the amount of the award. What the government said in its brief is Judge Fumpei expressly said, both in his original opinion and in his reconsideration opinion, that when Judge Fumpei said he relied on all the evidence, put himself in the position of a jury, and independently arrived at a jury verdict award, that means he relied on no evidence. Well, that's not only an inaccurate characterization of the facts. It really devalues what this court correctly called Judge Fumpei's intimate familiarity with the facts. The way I would put it is what this court wanted to buy on remand was Judge Fumpei's intimate familiarity with the facts and his best judgment. It said to him, please wrestle with this task. You're in the best position to do it. Come up with a number. He did it. That's what this court said. It's certainly what this court meant. It deserves to be affirmed. This case has been in litigation for 11 years.
You know, you're speaking sort of in bold strokes, which you're perfectly entitled to do, but I would be interested in your getting down to the nuts and bolts of questions such as the trial court's reliance, if the trial court did rely exclusively or in part, on the question of whether the regulators would have approved the failed loan transaction.
I'm happy to address that. Yeah.
First of all, let me ask you this. Do you read the trial court's opinion as resting with respect to that issue, exclusively on the regulatory prohibition, or do you understand that the regulatory prohibition issue to have been only one of the grounds on which the judge predicated his conclusion that a non-collateralized loan assumption would have occurred?
First of all, it's quite clear Judge Fronte said in his original opinion that he used the Shapiro model as corrected simply to facilitate, that's his own word, simply to facilitate the jury verdict judgment. It was the government, which then came back by way of reconsideration and said, no, 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 your award relies exclusively on this regulatory correction. Judge Fronte said in his reconsideration opinion, without even waiting for a response from us, because he was confident that he knew precisely what he had done, that is not what I did. And if Your Honor, I can point you to where he said that it facilitated, I believe it's at page 242, 67 Fed Claim. He says, to facilitate the analysis, the court adopts with one adjustment. But you needn't look any further than his valedictory statement, his conclusion. He says, I've relied on everything. So I think it is the government's characterization, certainly, but not an accurate characterization, that the jury verdict award relied solely on the regulatory
Well, I'm addressing a narrower, I think, issue with my question. And that is, if you look at, it's actually A120, and this is, I guess, in one of the internet cop versions of the opinion, so I don't have before me the page of the Fed Claim Reporter, but on A120, the court is referring to Professor Shapiro's testimony and then says, and this is where the court gets into the 584.6a, would have kept CFSB from assuming any debt without prior approval from FHLBB, I guess we mean FISLIC there.
There's no question. I'm sorry.
Okay. But the question that I have is, was this the exclusive ground on which the court was saying, with respect to this issue, that there would not have been such a transaction? That is to say, because it wouldn't have been approved.
No, Your Honor, and I don't know how I can do better than to point to his reconsideration.
Okay, what?
Because the product of that discussion, which is that there would be a 16.1% equity surrender, is then reiterated by Judge Fronte in his reconsideration order when he says that the figures and percentages, this is at A122,
right,
figures and percentages employed in the court's analysis, including the equity surrender portion, independently originated from a jury's assessment of the evidence presented. But let me put on
yeah, I guess I'm not, you seem to feel that that's absolutely conclusive. Maybe it is, but I'm maybe a little bit slow in picking up why it's conclusive, but I'm not sure I understand that to be addressed to the particular question that I'm trying to
Let me try to meet your question by saying the thrust of the jury verdict award is that damages are predicated upon a 16.1% equity surrender.
Right, debt sure. Costs.
What Judge Fronte said was that results from my review of all of the evidence. If the award depended exclusively on the regulatory correction, may I just address what the state of play was?
Sure. Now,
Professor Calamiris, in his opening testimony, his direct testimony, says there's no way that Professor Shapiro's model, which envisions a tax disadvantageous debt assumption.
All right. Right.
So, look, first of all, the transaction would never have been proposed.
Mr. That's what Calamiris says. You're right. Now, the question is, in my mind is, does Judge Fronte, you employ that, accept that and employ that as one of the grounds for his saying why the transaction wouldn't have occurred?
That it would be tax disadvantageous?
Well, or that there was any reason other than the regulatory prohibition.
Yes, he does. He says it in footnote 83, which I think you'll find at page 120, again, of the appendix. This is where you were pointing. He says, for purposes of this analysis, the court accepts Professor Calamiris' creation of Stone Holdings in 1989 in a mechanical sense. That is a very important holding, because what he's saying is, we know, this is what Professor Calamiris testified to, we know that in the real world, Mr. Fayal never assigned his debt to a holding company because of the tax disadvantage of doing so until Stone Holdings was created. Here's Bluebonnet, the thrift. Above it is CFSB, the holding company. In 1997, Mr. Fayal created Stone Holdings as a new holding company above CFSB. In a tax-free exchange, Mr. Fayal had Stone Holdings assume his debt And also he gave his CFSB stock. It was an asset paired with a debt.
It's an exchange of property, non-taxable, right?
Exactly. And that's why the first point that's important about this is he's saying, I understand Mr. Fail would never even have proposed a tax disadvantageous exchange of debt where he saddled CFSB with his debt before you get to the regulatory issue. That's why footnote 83 really frames what he was saying. He's saying, in essence, I accept for purposes of this correction that there has to be an asset paired with a debt. Now, that's important because we know also, and Professor Callamir has testified to this, that the regulators actually approved that transaction. The third piece that we know is what the regulations themselves said. Now, what Professor Callamir said is, I can tell you that when you saddle CFSB with this debt, its equity value plummets by 75%. And there's no way any regulator is going to let a regulated holding company do that. But that's as far as his talking about the regulations went. Professor Shapiro was then cross-examined by the regulations. He said, I don't know anything about this other than I'm sure the regulations would apply and I'm sure there would be some way to come up with a tax-free exchange. Well, that's Stone-Holmes. That is what Judge Foute adopted. Now, the third piece was the regulations mean what they mean. It is a matter of law. We briefed it in our post-trial brief. The government said, no, no, we don't need to address the words and the language of the regulations. It's all really just a question of tax efficiency. Judge Foute then enters his judgment. For the first time in reconsideration, they come forward and they say, no, no, that's not the plain meaning of the regulations. Here's what the plain meaning of the regulations is. Well, they waived that argument. You can't wait in a situation where you said to a trial judge, review all of the evidence, take all the submissions from the parties, use your best judgment, which is what he did. And then he did it on the basis of the record that was before him. And then the government, for the first time in reconsideration, says, I'm sorry, we want to come forward with this argument. But we're still right, even on the language of the regulations. The regulations would have prohibited that transfer. Because the regulations prohibit any transaction that would saddle a regulated holding company with an imprudent or unnecessary financial burden. Taking on additional debt without any additional income that plummets your equity value by 75% fails the regulations. And we have argued that in our brief, but I don't think the court even needs to reach that question because the government has waived that argument. Now, that was what was before Judge Foute. However you look at it, whether you look at it, as we say, holistically based on all the evidence, whether you look at it on what was before him at the time he rendered judgment, and whether you look at it on the basis of the government's untimely, or as Judge Foute put it, belated motion for reconsideration, his award is supported across the board. It's what this court asked Judge Foute to do, and it deserves to be upheld. Now, we have said in our cross-appeal that sure, Judge Foute proceeded to a jury verdict analysis after he rejected Professor Callamiris' model, but he should not have rejected Professor Callamiris' model because the assumptions he rejected were based entirely on the law of this case.
I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, just to be clear, that your cross-appeal is a conditional cross-appeal, right?
It is conditional if this court affirms the jury verdict, absolutely.
If the court affirms jury verdict award, you're not pressing your cross appeal.
Correct, absolutely.
To be perfectly clear.
And just, I say I'm out of time, but to answer the court's question, because our cross appeal seeks a modification of the judgment, we're comfortable that having a conditional cross appeal.
I'm not questioning its propriety, I'm just questioning whether you're asserting it regardless of the disposition of.
No, we are not.
All right.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Berger. Mr. Cohen.
In plaintiff's post-trial brief, they set forth this argument that no regulator would have approved the CFSB's assumption of the debt by Mr. Fail. We responded by saying there's no competent evidence to that effect in the record. The plaintiffs included two sentences with respect to the regulation, 584.6. When the judge relied upon that regulation solely, we filed a motion for reconsideration. The judge didn't say we had waived the argument. He said it was belated, but he also accepted the argument because in his motion for reconsideration, he no longer relied upon the regulation. He said, I'm relying upon my view of the evidence as a whole. Now, with respect to the argument that this court mandated the use of a jury verdict, without deciding whether or not the plaintiff's failure to comply to prove their damages was justifiable. This court in 2003 said specifically that the jury verdict cannot be applied unless it is the plaintiff's failure to prove its damages is justifiable. With respect to the judge's holistic view of the record, in effect he's saying, my judgment is unreviewable. I can choose an amount, $96 million, based upon my view of the record, but I don't have to explain why. And as a consequence, it's impossible for us to show where he went wrong or for this court to review his judgment. And finally, and again, would like to reiterate the fact that there's absolutely no evidence in the record that this regulation would have applied or the manner in which the regulators would have interpreted it. The court's judgment appears to be based solely upon this idea that it has complete discretion to pick any number that it wishes. And that cannot be the law, and the judgment should be reversed or remanded for entry of a judgment of $10 million.
Could I ask you a question, Mr. Cohen, just on the mechanics of how the judge derived the particular number? It's a number with great specificity to it. It's not $96 million or $100 million. Right. It's 96, 7, 98, 842. Is there a spreadsheet anywhere or anything in the record that indicates arithmetically how one would come up with that number? Because I didn't see anything.
As I recall, there is a demonstrative exhibit in the record that the plaintiffs produced that indicated the various damages. It's called their sensitivity analysis, but I don't have the citation.
Let me ask the question this way, same question. If I were to take the equity surrender number and reduce it from 49, whatever it was, point something, down to 16, whatever it was, point something, would I come up with a number like this?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you both, Mr. Cohen and Mr. Berger. The case is taken under submission.
Honorable Court is adjourned from day to day.